You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks on Talk 1260 KTRC with your host, Dirk Norris.
New Mexico Filmworks is a program of the New Mexico State Film Office brought to you through the generosity of Hutton Broadcasting. A little later in the show, I'll be speaking with founder and CEO of Cinefilm, Lance Maurer. But my first guests here in the studio are Don Gray, writer, director, actor of Where Sheep May Safely Graze, and Ann Kirby, producer of Where Sheep May Safely Graze, winner of several awards at the 48-Hour Film Project this year, which means they're going to Filmapalooza in California. That's just next week, right?
That's right.
So, Ann, let me get a little bit of your background. How did you get into film?
I just actually stumbled into it, actually with the first production I was ever in was a 48-hour that I acted in 5 years ago.
5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And from there, started networking and just kind of segued into producing.
And what was the film that you did?
It was called All the Right Tools.
And who else was involved? And you said you acted in that.
I acted in that. I played a 70s porn star.
Oh, excellent. Hi. Yeah. Wait a minute. I'm having a flip. No.
And that film actually did not win best film, but it did win best writing, as I recall. So.
And were you kind of recruited into it, or did you volunteer, say, here I am, I'd like to work on a project?
I volunteered and said I would like to work on a project. And
you've been involved ever since?
Yes, I have.
Every year?
Every year, 5 years in a row.
Terrific. Don, how did you get into film? And I should, our listeners are familiar with your name, also the contracted locations coordinator for the State Film Office, also an instructor at Santa Fe University of Art and Design, and filmmaker.
Yeah, so I was one of those kids who would swipe his mom's 8mm film projector and, you know, make movies, little 3-minute 8mm movies. And, you know, I grew up doing a lot of theater, acting in theater. And when I went to school, I actually went to study ceramics, actually, in an art school. And I ended up not really liking the ceramics department. And at that time, there was a guy who was, you know, in a little corner lab, and he was doing an art studio using video. And at that time, very, very early computers, digital arts. And so I wasn't really married to the medium so much. I just wanted freedom to create. And so I ended up studying that. And that's sort of how I have always sort of made my living, is doing creative digital things, using digital tools to do creative things, whether it's printing or digital photography. I actually got my first job here in New Mexico in the film industry because in 2003, I was the only local photographer they could find to go shoot some location photos who owned a digital camera in 2003. So they wanted me to go shoot some stuff and come back at lunch and show Ron Howard, the director, some pictures at lunch. And that's how I ended up getting into it at that particular time.
And Anne, you're acting. Have you always acted?
I started acting in 1994 here in Santa Fe. I think my first production was in the Fiesta Melodrama. I was the lead in that.
And nice.
That long ago.
And Anne, by the way, is in the 48, is in Where Sheep May Safely Graze as well, actually.
Playing
Mrs.
what part?
What was the name of the character?
I can't even remember
the name of the character now.
you and your husband are going to a theater or leaving as you're talking
Mark,
to the...
Mark. Yeah. That was one of the required characters that we had to have.
Right.
Well, and that's the way the 48 works, is that, you know, on Friday night, you draw out of a hat a genre.
Right.
And, you know, there's comedy, there's drama, there's cop detective, there's, you know, there's a variety of things. And then... there are also some requirements you have to meet. One of them is a character that has to be in the story. And this was Mark. Why can't I remember the last name of that character?
Anyways,
that person had to be a critic of some kind.
Right.
And then there was a prop we had to use, which was confectioner's sugar. Mm-hmm. And then there was a line of dialogue that we had to use, which was
Icy Stars.
And that's the formula for the 48-hour. You have to have those elements in whatever genre you're shooting. and you have to do it all within 48 hours. You have to write it, you have to shoot it, edit it, put it all together in that 48-hour time frame.
That's right. Exactly.
What is the value of doing that?
That's what I said to Anne when she approached me, actually.
I found that because that's how I started learning how to produce. Mm-hmm. You really learn how to economize time. And you also learn who you can work with in this industry and who is good at collaborating.
Right.
And I got very lucky because I didn't really know Don. And I decided 3 weeks before that I wanted to do a 48 and saw him at the airport in Los Angeles and approached him and said, I saw your poster on Facebook. Would you like to direct my 48-hour film? And he
As so many collaborations begin.
Said yes. Yes.
At the baggage claim at the Sunport.
So you had seen his Facebook and I thought, gee, this is a guy I need to do a 48-hour with.
Yeah, I hadn't even seen any of his movies, but I saw his poster of a movie that he had done, that he had shot before.
See, kids, it's important to have a good one sheet. That's a good.
And it was so beautiful, and I thought, well, I only got 3 weeks. I got to get somebody.
Was that Delia?
No, that was it Delia?
It was a lot of sky.
I don't remember which one that was. So I've done actually 3 short films prior to this one, actually. So it could have been any one of those. And, you know, to be quite frank, I had always avoided the 48 because I thought it was kind of insane to try to do a movie in 48 hours. And I haven't actually necessarily changed my idea about that. But, you know, sometimes actually limiting your choices is really a great place to start creatively. And to get you to do some things differently. When I was in art school, I had this drawing teacher, and he was always trying to get us to make marks differently than we were used to making on the paper. And so we'd come into class on any given day, and he'd do things like put splints on our arms or, you know, make us draw without looking at the paper and things like that. And that's really, for me personally, creatively, that's really what it did. It really took me out of my comfort zone, which, quite frankly, is preparation. My comfort zone is preparation. I've always been a huge preparation guy. I've always believed the adage that but before you even roll camera, you've already made the film you're going to make,
right?
In preparation. And so this is a case where literally essentially no preparation.
Yeah. And something to add to that. No, I'm sorry. Putting that time restraint on it, it's kind of putting it in a crucible. Really refines what you have to do. It eliminates all that prep that you were talking about. And you really have to learn or be able to work with your collaborators to get this thing done. This year, there were something like 52 entries, I think.
53 teams. And of those 53... amazingly, 52 actually completed their films. There was only one team that didn't actually complete their film, which is extraordinary. And also was, by the way, another limitation for us because, as Anne said, we only got into it a couple of weeks before. And with, as you can imagine, with 53 teams, it was hard to find people to be on our team because everybody else was already on a team. But boy, we got some spectacular people on our team just by good fortune, I think. And that made a huge, I mean, we have to give as much credit to that as anything.
Sure. Now, how did that work? Did you know Anne when she approached you, or who is this crazy lady?
We knew each other sort of cursively through the industry and that sort of thing. Didn't know each other well. We were friends on Facebook. It was sort of one of those things where I kind of know who that is. Oh, yeah, okay, I'll accept the friend. You know, and so she had this great thumbnail picture of her as Glenda the Good Witch, which I loved, actually. It was actually probably the reason why I accepted her friend request was because she had this great picture of herself as Glenda the Good Witch. I thought it was an awesome picture. So
it's
we
all
didn't,
in the image.
Yeah, exactly. So we didn't really know each other all that well. And that could have ended badly, perhaps in bloodshed, but it didn't actually in the end.
And one thing that I would like to add on top of all the pressure of just creating a 48, we had at 7 o'clock we had drawn our genre and whatnot, and then we all go in and meet and collaborate, and decide what we're going to do. And at that time, we had cast an actor that we had written or formed a story around.
Right.
And so we met for a couple of hours, and then everybody left to go. The art left, and everybody left, and Don went to go write. And the actor that we had cast called and said he was not going to be able to do it. So we had formed a story. And and then we had to, now we do not have our lead actor, and we have to come up with another story. And Don ended up being the lead in the in the movie.
And called me and asked me what kind of shirts I had brought with me down to Albuquerque and whether any of them would fit the genre of the story we were trying to tell. It was essentially the phone call.
And was this your acting debut?
No. Actually, I actually, you know, like I say, I sort of come from an acting background, mostly theater, actually. But I had stopped doing that, and I'm much more interested in directing. But I oftentimes end up in my films because I'm an actor. I know who will show up on the day, and I trust myself fairly well. And so actually, I've been in some of my other films too.
And I would like to say that Don is a really good actor. He, before we did the 48, he came down and showed me the movies that he had shot before. Mm-hmm. And one of them, after the last movie that you showed me, I said, I don't know who that is, but that guy is really good. And he said it was him.
And she didn't believe me.
He was so able to transform himself, his look and his voice and everything. He's a remarkable actor.
It's what it's all about. We got to take a break. You're listening to Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and we'll be right back with Don and Ann. We're back. You're listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. My guests are Don Gray and Ann Kirby. We're talking about their film, Where Sheep May Safely Graze, which won the 48-hour film project this year and is off to Filmapalooza, which is next week. I think it starts March 7th.
Correct.
In California this year. Last year it was in Taos, which was very convenient for New Mexico filmmakers.
Yeah.
So how does this work? You won several categories, but there's just one that sends it to Filmapalooza, right?
Yeah, Best Picture.
Best Picture, yeah. So we were talking about getting your crew together. Who was responsible for that? And did you get the rest of the crew, or was it the two of you?
It was both of us.
Yeah, we both did, since we both knew, you know, we know people in the industry, and you know, some of the people I knew weren't available and vice versa, but you know, we managed to find enough people between the two of us. In fact, I don't think if both of us hadn't had the kind of connections in the industry we had, like, seriously, it would have been Ann and I shooting the film.
Yeah. Right.
And the young boy that was in there was terrific.
Yeah, Tino Sherwood is just a wonderful little actor, really a wonderful little boy. And I have to say, I worked that little boy so hard. He's been in two films, actually. And he's just so wonderful, very soulful, really has an amazing presence on camera. And, oh God, he just works so hard. Amazing for a little boy like that to really stick and not be bored throughout the day. Because a lot of filmmaking is kind of boring.
Sure.
But he comes from Española. I originally cast him in a film called Delia that I did, and he did a fantastic job. He just has this great presence on screen. Mm-hmm. He had never acted before Delia. And so when we started to kind of kick around some ideas of some people to bring in, I really wanted to bring Tino in because I just thought he was just so great and just he really carries a piece. Amazing to say that about a 9-year-old little boy, but he really does. He really provides the soul and the anchor of a story, I think, as some, you know, really good actors do. So.
Right. And who else is on the crew?
Gene Harrison was our production designer, and we got Dave Valdez, who works at Reels Channel, to do our editing, which we got so lucky with that because we got to edit out at Reels Channel.
Oh, right.
Which I don't think we could have done it if we hadn't been able to use their
That's where
equipment.
A lot of 48 stumble, actually, is in post. You know, it's one thing to shoot it, then it's right. another thing to scramble and get all the footage converted and cut into something that yeah. makes sense and run it out to its final version. I mean, that's where a lot of films run into trouble, and Dave really helped us out.
It seems like in a lot of these films, they just try to take on too much. And yeah. you guys, you had two locations, basically, that you used. In the house,
we
and
had
then,
one.
Didn't you have an outside scene,
was
that outside the house?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was outside of the house.
Okay, great. Yeah, so you're really working in a confined space that you don't have, logistically, there's a lot less involved.
And that was what I learned from my third 48-hour that I produced when we had 13 locations.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
I realized that was really a challenge.
Well, and as a locations professional myself, I mean, to be honest with you, I try to get Hollywood films to dial back the number of locations they're going to try to shoot because that is one of the things that eats up your time. You know, it's moving from one to another. That doesn't appear on screen. You know, the time you take to move the company across town to another location doesn't show up on screen. So
right.
we had decided to be really efficient. That was really one of the things that we made sure we did.
And I think one of the beautiful aspects of our film is that Dawn found this amazing house mm-hmm. that was already essentially set decorated.
Yeah, a Victorian house in Albuquerque that I had actually used as a location manager on two previous films, Beer Fest and Around the Bend, and this wonderful couple, the Hilliards, that owned it. And Mike, the husband, is an antique collector, and you could step into the house and it felt like period. It felt period. There was very little you had to do,
right.
which also was something that I think we decided to do that would give us a lot of production value. And also, you know, the genre we drew was cop detective, and so we actually decided to set it in period, which I think really made it stand out in a way, because it's easy to do the CSI and the sort of modern take on
sure.
on cop detective, but you don't see a period cop detective very well, very
right
often.
and with everybody else shooting in Albuquerque, you see a lot of Southwest, but
yeah.
this is Victorian,
totally
and,
different
and
look
period,
and,
so, yeah.
so it was like it was really like a breath of fresh air. And by the way, I want to also mention our hair and makeup person, who I want to mention her because we stupidly left her off the credit list on the first playing of the film, inadvertently. That's one of the things that happened when you were rushing around. But Anne Nguyen did an amazing job on our lead actress,
mm-hmm.
who when you meet her in person looks like a beautiful modern day woman, and she and Anne just transformed her into this period domestic maid character, you know,
right.
that was just really extraordinary. I mean, I couldn't believe when she walked out of the hair and makeup that she looked like she was in 1930. It was really an amazing transformation.
Well, I guess that quality of work is one of the reasons you guys won.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I do. Well, look, I think we had a lot of production value. I think we had a lot of really great people. Mark Swords, our mm-hmm. photographer, our director of photographer, did an amazing job shooting it. But really, I think what Anne and I decided from the very beginning was we were going to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to be our driving force. It was a story. It didn't matter where it was. It didn't matter the actors. It didn't matter. We were going to tell a story which would be engaging. And by the way, and we were going to take the quote-unquote limitations or the difficulties of 48 and turn them into strengths. For example, you know, the line of dialogue, I See Stars.
Right.
You know, I watched quite a few 48s before we actually did the thing, just to sort of get a feel for it. I could almost always pick out the line of dialogue that was required.
Sure, they put a marquee around it.
Yeah, it just didn't
right.
seem to fit. And we actually used the line of dialogue to actually drive the story,
mm-hmm.
and I think that really made a big difference in the final product.
Yeah, I agree. Some of the stuff is just really pointed out. You didn't make a big deal about the prop that you had to use with the confectioner's
mm-hmm.
sugar. It was just kind of there, I think it adds to the story by minimalizing it.
Right. Exactly.
We just got a minute or so left, and so what happens in California?
Filmmakers from around the world, I believe they have over
115
mm. filmmakers coming in mm-hmm. to screen their best picture. And I believe there are 10 winners mm-hmm. out of these 115. And those 10 winners will get the opportunity to screen their film in Cannes.
In Cannes, which is coming up in May, I think you said.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you're not going to be able to attend, but Don, you're going.
I'm going. Unfortunately, Ann is not.
So it'll be an opportunity for you to see quite a few of these.
I'm going to bring a picture of her with me.
Okay. Yeah, you can.
I'm having a tie printed with her face on it because I want everybody to know that she really did an extraordinary job. And really, this was all her idea from the beginning anyways. As I was claiming my bag at the Sun Porn, I had no idea what I was in for. But I want to give Ann a lot of credit.
Well, and I would just like to say when I went up to him, I said, you know, I have no expectation ever of winning this. I just want to have a good time. It's just fun for me. And Don said, well, I am going to win it.
Well, we have to go. It's been a delight talking with you both. And good luck. Best wishes for next week. And let us know how it turns out.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll let you know.
You've been listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. We'll be right back with Lance Maurer. We're back. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and this is New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. You can hear this show streaming Saturdays at 11 a.m. on SantaFe.com by clicking on the Talk 1260 KTRC Radio button. You can also hear this and previous shows on podcast by going to SantaFe.com, clicking on the podcast link, and looking for the New Mexico Film Works link. On the phone right now, I have Lance Maurer, CEO of Cinefilm down in Albuquerque, a company that does image processing for broadcast and film. Welcome, Lance.
Hi, how are you, Dirk?
I'm very good. So, Lance, give us a little bit of your background before we start talking about Cinefilm.
Sure. I'm born here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I was raised here and went to school here. I got my degree in mechanical engineering down in New Mexico State. Started working in the aerospace industry here, but having a passion for filmmaking, sort of tinkered on nights and weekends. And about 7 or 8 years ago, I decided I no longer wanted to be behind a desk every day and wanted to get out and do my own thing. So I started a software company called Cinefilm, and we've been working hard at that ever since.
So what exactly does Cinefilm do?
Well, Cinefilm is a company that provides software solutions to broadcasters and studios. Those solutions include image processing that helps optimize different types of content. We have two flagship products called Tachyon and Dark Energy, and one is geared more towards broadcast and one is geared more towards theatrical release. And the image processing that we do tends to, it's designed to make images look a lot better, and there's a lot of variety of ways you can do that. The first is doing frame rate conversion and format conversion properly, and the other is by controlling noise and texture in the image.
And you say doing frame rate conversion properly. Are there methods out there that are doing it improperly?
Yeah, there certainly are, and this has really been a byproduct of the digital explosion over the last few years. Mm-hmm. You know, for decades and a century, if you want to say it that way, video and television and theatrical were tightly controlled by standards and video engineers. And in the last, you know, 5-6 years, there's been an explosion of tool sets and content and access. And as a result, people tend to cut and manipulate images and content without really paying much attention to the frame rate or the standards that they're working on. And a lot of that also has to do with improper 2-3 pull down and these things that were incorporated sometime in the last 5 to 10 years in order to make video look more like film. So what ends up happening is you get mixed frames and ghosted frames and a variety of frames, and when you're remixing all of that content together, it just makes for a big problem, basically. And so our software goes in there and cleans those types of problems up.
When you were thinking about this, I mean, and starting your company, is this something you saw and that just thought, gee, there just ought to be a better way? Is that how that kind of came about?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I mean, essentially, when I started the software company, I certainly did not have have in mind that I would be, you know, 10 years later working in broadcast on standards conversions. Essentially, I set out to try to make a tool set that could properly make digital video look like film, and that in order to do that, I needed to be able to re-photograph images in time. So we developed a motion vector engine, and in order to basically move pixels around to when and where we wanted it, and in order to synthetically model motion blur. And on top of that, we also developed a very high-grade film grain modeling tool set. And the original vision was just to create this set of tools for filmmakers to make video look like film, and it ended up opening up sort of Pandora's box of applications. So that's what we've been handling ever since.
And you and I have had this discussion about just the look of video versus the look of film.
Mm-hmm.
And you had an interesting kind of analogy talking about the storytelling and using your imagination to fill in kind of between frames. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a real interesting topic that's coming up right now, especially. In fact, I hosted a roundtable last week at the Hollywood Post Alliance on the topic of high frame rate. And essentially what we're seeing in the industry is a move toward capturing at higher frame rate and higher resolution as a standard for digital cinema. And eventually I would argue that would also probably be applied to cinematic television episodic type series.
That higher frame rate, for an example, is what Jackson is doing with The Hobbit at 48 frames per second.
Right. It sounds like I'm getting off track, but I'm not. It's related. And essentially, what I've discovered in my research, and while we've been working so hard on frame rate conversions and these things, is that when you're watching cinema at 24 frames per second, your brain is recording faster than that, and it needs to fill in the blanks. And when it has to fill in the blanks, something gets triggered in your subconscious that sort of ignites your imagination. When you're watching 48 frames per second, it's arguable that you are shutting off that mechanism. So I think what people are experiencing when they're watching high frame rate content is they say it feels too realistic, and I concur. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not going to shoot high frame rates just because of I'm getting off track here. The bottom line is yes, watching something in 24 frames per second ignites your subconscious, and watching something at 48 frames per second kind of turns that off, and that's sort of the ongoing discussion right now.
It's an interesting term. Saying it's too real.
Mm-hmm.
How can that be? I mean, what is happening? And it sounds like you've done a lot of research on this. What's happening in your brain when that part of your imagination, I guess, is being turned off, and you're just subjected to these images? Are you not able to process the images as much?
No. What happens is, you know, I learned a lot in the last few weeks. I've been doing some more research, and it's much more complex than I'm making it sound, because it's also related to how your eyes move horizontally and vertically and track things and all these different things. But what it boils down to is that we see and record somewhere between 40 and 60 frames per second.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're watching something at 24, that means your brain is filling in the other 16.
Yeah.
And when you're watching something that's at 48, your brain isn't. So that means that when you're watching something at high frame rate, that's why it feels synthetic and real. And the jury is out right now as to whether that's something that the audience is going to want to experience in the theatrical works, in the theatrical space.
Right. A part of that, I think, is an aesthetic. What just seems pleasing to watch. And I'm just thinking that younger kids looking at more digital visual information are going to maybe look at film and film grain and say, wow, that looks strange, rather than being this kind of the standard aesthetic.
Yeah, it remains to be seen whether that's going to be the case. I mean, the bottom line is studios are putting content out in the big screen, and they want to make it worth the $15 or the $10 price of entry. And there's a variety of things happening right now. One is that you know, audio is improving. Dolby Atmos is a new technology that's really making audio astounding to listen to. It's even more technologically advance in 7.1. You've got 3D, you know, that tends to be, I'm not a big fan personally of 3D, but it's drawing people to the theaters, and now you've got this high frame rate. And I guess, you know, to me, I personally am not a big fan. If I had a choice between the 24 frames per second and the high frame rate, I would choose the former. But we could fill an hour up easily talking more about these things for certain.
Right. So rather than doing that, let's go on to some of the other stuff that Cinefilm does. And your product is sold worldwide. There's companies all over the world that are seeking you out.
That's correct. We have clients in post-production and in studios around the world, primarily in the hot spots of production like Germany, England, certainly North America, some in Japan. China is starting to explode. So, yeah, we are worldwide at this point. We're specialists in what we do. We're considered sort of the special forces in image processing.
And in one of your presentations you gave down in Las Cruces, I think it was, maybe a year ago, you were talking about being an entrepreneur and, you know, finding your kind of spot and just doing it well.
Yeah.
That seems rather important to you.
Well, I think it's not just important to me. I think it's important for any entrepreneur or any you know, up-and-coming expert in either post-production or production. You need to find out, you know, you need to find a niche, and then you need to excel in that niche. You can't do everything. You can't be a great director and shooter and writer. And I mean, if you're trying to do everything, you're going to be killing yourself. And I, from my experience, I think that people start to settle into, you know, what it is that they do and they do well. And when you start focusing on that, then success follows.
And that success is a result of people recognizing the professionalism and the quality work and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I'm a big proponent of quality matters. I mean, that's really what I sell on the marketplace, and I don't sweep problems under the rug, and I don't circumvent hard, difficult issues. We just, you know, we're very honest about what we can and can't do, and I think honesty in the end pays off, and I think that if you focus on very, very high quality, that always pays off. Even though it's a longer road, it certainly ends up being a more satisfying one.
Boy, I you know, Lance, I couldn't agree with you more. And we can talk about this in the next segment. We've got to take a break. This is New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio, and we'll be right back with Lance Maurer.
We don't talk about rather do without.
EarthCare is youth leadership for community change dedicated to empowering and educating youth to create healthy and sustainable communities. Be a part of the solution, not part of the problem. For more information, go to santafe.com, keyword EarthCare.
Back. This is New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and I've been speaking with Lance Maurer, CEO and founder of Cinefilm. Welcome back, Lance.
Thank you.
You're also president of the New Mexico Post Alliance.
Yes, sir.
Tell us what the Post Alliance is, what it does, what it's about.
Yeah, absolutely. This is an organization, nonprofit, that we started about 3 or 4 years ago, we being a bunch of professional folks here in Albuquerque and in New Mexico in general that are working in post-production. It sort of is a fallout of the positive fallout, I should say. Fallout can be a negative word.
Yeah.
A fallout of the MISP organization that Eric Whitmore had put a lot of time and energy into. And I think that as that was starting to wind down, some of the post folks got together and said, we need to band together. And the original vision was a little lofty, but now we're focusing primarily on educating and providing information to local filmmakers and producers about modern technologies, methods, so that post-production quality can increase here.
The whole landscape of post-production is changing. Even the terminology, post isn't necessarily at the end anymore.
No, post-production is still certainly a well-defined group of processes, but you're exactly right. More of these processes are sneaking onto set, and a lot of that has to do with advances in technology. In fact, all of it does, and it's because now that you're no longer having to wait for film to be processed to look at dailies, now that you're doing digital content capture, you can look at these things on set, and as a result, directors and DPs are demanding, you know, they want to know exactly what their content is looking like. So they've actually got on-set color correction happening and these types of things.
What's the work environment like in New Mexico for post folks?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that post-production is an area that New Mexico should take seriously. And the reason I say that is because media in general is going to become, if it isn't already, America's number one export in this century. I mean, just content creation, content management, content delivery. And, I mean, they were telling me some staggering numbers last week. Like, there's more hours loaded up on YouTube every week than was captured last century in television. And it's pretty mind-boggling. So being able to handle and process and manage that, I mean, that is what the post-production is. So, you know, there's a huge opportunity if New Mexico wants to be a player in that space.
And that's even down to using Lambda Rail and fiber optics to transfer files back and forth and to store them and that sort of thing as well.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, Los Angeles is still the epicenter for post-production. I mean, they've got decades and decades of experience and brick and mortar down there, but I can tell you that they're very aggressive out there in being forward thinking and dealing with digital content. And it would be nice if New Mexico could find a way to incentivize some of those folks to build some brick and mortar here. And I mean, that's sort of an ongoing battle, but it would, I think that would be a big first step. And part of that is the Lambda Rail. You're right.
There are certain aspects of post-production that are incentivized in New Mexico that are part of the 25% if it's done here in the state. But it's there's still a long way to go, I think.
Well, you know, I guess some of the mechanisms are in place, certainly, but mm-hmm. but really to for us to thrive and to become, say another Vancouver, I mean, we have to look at what Vancouver did right and wrong. I mean, right now, Vancouver, I believe, is struggling with their top-heavy tax incentives. I think they went too far. Mm-hmm. I mean, time will tell on that. But they drew, you know, ILM, they drew Sony Pictures from New Mexico. They've got EA Arts. They've got all the video game folks up there. I mean, I've heard somewhere in the number of 40,000 post-production people working up there.
Wow.
I mean, that's a city of post-production people. And right. And the way they did it was by tax incentives. Now, that being said, we got to make it viable and you have to make it sustainable and you can't overcorrect. But I think in order for us to play in that space, we need a dedicated task force to really understand and draw those folks here. And we could certainly do that.
Recently with the Academy Awards and special effects in particular, feeling not recognized, and so many of these special effects companies that are they're going bankrupt while the films that they work on are making billions of dollars. Where did that fall in with all of this?
That's a really terrific question, and I don't have a good answer for you. I can tell you that the landscape for post-production is changing daily, and the fact that one of the main players that, like you say, was nominated for an Academy Award went bankrupt on the same week is you know, it proves that things are changing dramatically. Now, I'm a firm believer that when there's chaos, there's opportunity, and I think that what we're finding is that post-production facilities are popping up all over the place, but they're struggling to try to find the sustainable formula. That doesn't mean that some aren't. Some are, certainly. But what this all boils down to is I think you're going to see in the next couple of years, just like there's an editors union and there's a writers union and there's an actors guild, there needs to be a post-production guild. And there needs to be so that we're not always at the tail end of the budget. Because in reality, post-production is one of the most important steps of the whole process. It's as equally important as the production. And if you're always trying to cut corners going into post, boy, it's just such a stressful place to be. And I think that what you're seeing is that is you're going to see from folks like the Visual Effects Society, you might see something along the lines of a guild starting to form to help protect people.
Yeah, and we just have a minute or so left. Is it because the landscape keeps changing so rapidly that there hasn't been any kind of guild to this point?
I can't answer that. I think it's just a matter of people just finally getting tired of having, you know, work one day and work not, and then you know, the ups and downs. I think that's how unions are typically formed. And you know, I don't know a whole lot about what's going on with that, though, to be honest. You just have to get someone else on.
I liked your comment about budgeting, and it seems like it's always a shortfall for post-production for some of the films from, you know, in New Mexico, our filmmakers. And it's like, yeah, everything, they ran out before they got to, you know, deal with the sound and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I hope that becomes, I don't know, more in their conscience or something. I don't know.
I mean,
that you guys do.
Yeah, it doesn't look, the reality is that if you want a film to look good, you need to start at the back and work to the front.
Right.
You know, and you need to plan accordingly, and you need to pick your resolution carefully and your camera carefully and your post-processing carefully, and then take that to the set and shoot with that, because, you know, I've seen shortcuts really kill great projects.
Right.
Yeah, you know. And
Lance, we have to go. I really appreciate you being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Dirk. I appreciate your time.
Okay, this is New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. We'll be back next week.
Started listening, I'm feeling free. Stop acting like I